This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. New Bedford has been called the city that lights the world. The moniker, of course, derived from New Bedford's central role in the production of whale oil. As whaling declined, manufacturing took its place. And by the mid-20th century, New Bedford was once again helping to light the world with factories that produced electrical transformers and capacitors. Both whaling and manufacturing were major economic drivers for the city, but they took a toll on the harbor and communities that made the city so prosperous. To this day, the sediment at the bottom of New Bedford Harbor carries high levels of heavy metals and oily chemicals called PCBs that can cause cancer and a host of other health problems. John Farrington grew up in New Bedford during the heyday of electrical manufacturing. He went on to become an environmental chemist who helped put New Bedford Harbor on the Environmental Protection Agency's list of the most toxic waste sites in the country. Decades later, Farrington has retired from research, but New Bedford Harbor remains a site in need of cleanup. John Farrington is Dean Emeritus at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, also adjunct professor at the University of Massachusetts Dartmouth's School of Marine Science and Technology. He joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. John Farrington, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you, Heather. Pleasure to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the electrical manufacturing industry and the chemicals that are now one of the main reasons New Bedford Harbor has been targeted by the EPA for decades, and that's PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls. Why were they being used in such great quantities?
Well, PCBs were one of the chemicals that came out of the synthesis of various types of organic chemicals, and they had very special properties. First of all, they weren't very flammable. And second of all, they worked very well in terms of being the types of chemicals you would like to have in capacitors, in transformers, and those types of electrical devices. And so that's how we ended up with the PCBs, with the electrical manufacturing going on in New Bedford. The various companies, mainly Aerovox Corporation, later AVX, and then Cornell Dubilier Corporation, later owned by Federal Pacific Electric, they moved into the mill buildings that were available because the textile industry had moved out after the period of time that textiles took over from whaling.
At that point, I mean, this was right around 1940.
Yes.
The PCBs had, as you've mentioned, these very beneficial properties from an mm-hmm. industrial sense. But we already had a sense that they were very dangerous for people's health. How were companies able to continue using these chemicals?
Well, there's a period of time. It's true. If you go back in the literature and look in the 1930s, you can find publications with respect to the health of workers in various plants, not only with the polychlorinated biphenyls, but especially also with another group of chemicals very similar called polychlorinated naphthalenes. And certainly during World War II, in the height of the shipbuilding industry for the war, for freighters and for warships, it became clear that some of the polychlorinated naphthalenes were causing problems with respect to the electrical conduits and electrical lines put into ships in terms of the workers in those shipyards.
So were people working in the factories in New Bedford aware of this?
I don't know.
Growing up, I mean, what was it like to grow up in New Bedford with these two companies and this manufacturing as kind of a centerpiece of the economy? Was there a sense that these companies were helping the city, helping the communities?
Oh, certainly. There was a sense that they were helping the communities. There were some concerns. I mean, people did know. For example, I have to state that my mother was an industrial nurse, and she and I lived with my aunt and uncle, her older sister. She worked initially right after I was born for Aerovox Corporation and then moved later, I can't remember how many years, to Cornell. But I remember years and years later, after I came to Woods Hole and after it became apparent that there were lots of problems with PCBs in the harbor, I asked her, Mom, did you ever have any health problems in the plant? And she was very old then, and so, you know, you can't take this as an epidemiological interview. But she said, well, we had problems when we started using some aspects of that new oil.
The new oil being the PCBs.
That's what I took it for. She didn't really, I think, know what that was. And I said, well, what happened? She said, well, we started having rashes. which is chloracne, which is a very classic symptom of exposure to chlorinated aromatic compounds, as I understand it. Now, I need to be clear to you and your listeners that I'm not a medical doctor, an epidemiologist, but that's clear in the literature that that's one of the cases. So I asked her, what did you do? And she said, well, they washed down the plant in between the shifts, which meant they washed the floor off and machinery and things like that, which meant the material went into the storm drains and then eventually into the harbor.
And that was enough to hopefully keep the next shift from getting a major rash.
That's about as far as we got. I'm sorry. In fact, in retrospect, I wish that I had actually had her interviewed by an epidemiologist, but the past is the past and we can't redo it.
Did that experience growing up in New Bedford, did you have an awareness that there was a problem, and did that in any way influence your later decision to pursue a career in science?
No, not at all. I got into science because I was in elementary school and getting ready to go to seventh grade in junior high school when Sputnik went up. And so I'm of the Sputnik generation where clearly the expectation was made. Well, the expectation was that those of us who had any inclination to have an interest in science and engineering needed to go into that because it was our, quote, national duty, unquote. And it was pretty clear at that time that that was the case, because I'd gone through grade school where the Cold War, was beginning to really ratchet up. And I can distinctly remember what we call duck and cover drills, in case there was an atomic bomb dropped. You get under your desk and covered your head. And Lord knows what that would have done. Probably protect us from the glass flying, but that's about it.
But your sense was that becoming a scientist would somehow contribute positively to...
It would contribute positively, but what kind of scientist wasn't clear. Yeah.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. John Farrington. We're talking about the history of environmental contamination in New Bedford Harbor, a history that he has experienced both personally and studied professionally. How did you then go from a junior high student interested potentially even in space science, being really driven by Sputnik to pursue science, to a career in environmental chemistry?
Well, it was a convoluted route, but I'll cut to the chase and say that my initial goal was to become a military pilot. But I had a football injury in high school, and that kind of took care of the whole thing. And so even though I tried going into the platoon leader's class in the Marine Corps and aviation and so forth, I'm one of the few people, I think, that has an honorable discharge medical from the United States Marine Corps. And that was it. It was over. And so I couldn't do that. So I became more interested in chemistry. The only college I could afford to go to, given our family circumstances, was what was then New Bedford Institute of Technology, which then became Southeastern Massachusetts Technological Institute while I was there, became Southeastern Massachusetts University, and we now know it as UMass Dartmouth. And I had to work in the evenings three nights a week and on Saturdays as an assistant mechanic in the bowling alley to get additional money to go to school. And as is often the case, midway through I'm kind of ashamed to say this now, probably my grandchildren are listening, but I wasn't very focused on my studies until I got into my junior year when I had, a professor who really turned me around. It's a very common story. And I became interested in chemistry.
Did your mother support you and push you to go through college and pursue this?
Oh, absolutely. She was the first and the only person in her family among six sisters and brothers who went beyond high school. She went to a three-year nursing school. And she was very intent, as was my aunt and uncle, who were like grandparents to me, that I should go ahead and do what I could to get into college. They were very helpful.
Now, you were in college in the late 60s, just as the fields of environmental chemistry and, for that matter, the whole environmental movement was finding its feet and really blossoming. I mean, that must have been an exciting time. Did that become an influence kind of in the way that Sputnik had been earlier and influencing the directions you chose?
It came a little bit later because my wife, who I had met in high school in New Bedford, was also from New Bedford, was a nurse, and she went to nursing school. When we were married, after I had my bachelor's degree, I had the opportunity to stay and get a master's degree at what was then SMTI in chemistry. And so I started doing research in biochemistry on enzymes in cold water fish, halibut in particular. And my advisor knew enough about the field that said I should come down to Woods Hole and take a look at the MBL Woods Hole Library. And I did. And, of course, we all know what a jewel that library is. And especially in those days, you could walk in. It was one of the few libraries that you could walk in, sit down at a desk, and have the journals right there with you. I took a break, walked down the street, went into a noon talk at Redfield on chemical oceanography. They'd just come back from a cruise out to the Gulf Stream and the Sargasso Sea. And as I say, it was a magic moment. I said, wow, you can do chemistry in the oceans. And so I went and changed my whole mind from going to medical school and MD, PhD, which was probably a good thing for many potential future patients, and went to the oceanography school at URI, had a PhD in chemical oceanography. It was during that time, in the 68 to 69 and 1970 period, that things were really getting interesting and leading up to the first Earth Day. And I stumbled on, in my research, chronic oil pollution problems in Narragansett Bay.
So that's how you then made the connection back, I guess, to New Bedford and the history of pollution in the harbor?
Well, the connection was one more step. I came to Woods Hole as a postdoc with Max Bloomer because there had been an oil spill in West Falmouth in 1969.
Right.
And he had some of the more advanced analytical instruments, and I wanted to learn how to use them, gas chromatograph, mass spectrometer. And while I was here, I was working actually on samples from New York Bight. There was a colleague who was visiting from Switzerland, Walter Giger, who was studying with Max. Another long story, but we don't have time to go into that. And Walter came in. He was sampling in Buzzards Bay, and the outer New Bedford Harbor area was one of his areas that he sampled. And he was looking for compounds that are present in oil and in combustion products, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. And the technique he was using, mass spectrometry at the time, resulted in the fact that he had some interfering compounds, and he was getting all of these chlorinated biphenyls showing up in his analysis for polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in New Bedford Harbor. And Max Bloomer told him, well, go talk to John Farrington. He lived in New Bedford. And so Walter came and said, John, how come there are all these PCBs? And I said, oh, well, there's these two big manufacturing plants there for capacitors.
And at that point, they were still...
Oh, they were still
using, going.
Right. And only a few years before that, people who were analyzing throughout the world for pesticides, DDT, chlorinated pesticides, and were all aware of the fact that that was really causing real problems. Promiscuous use of those pesticides were creating problems for non-target organisms. As was
the silent spring.
Oh, eloquently explained to the public in Silent Spring. And the interesting aspect of that is that the analysis for DDT kept showing these interfering compounds that nobody knew what they were. And finally, in 1966-67, three different groups, one in Sweden, Søren Jensen's group, one in California, Bob Ricebarrow and 67, and one in the Netherlands, a Komen and colleagues, and they all identified that these extraneous peaks in this record that was also being used to measure DDT were PCBs. And so people then began to look at, well, where are these PCBs coming from? And they were as ubiquitous as the chlorinated pesticides, if not more so. Very, very much stable in the environment and transported by the atmosphere.
So you had a kind of an inside track on, at least in the New Bedford case, where these might have been coming from. Did it immediately click for you, and did you kind of immediately jump on this, or did it take a while?
Well, no, it took a while because I had a colleague, George Harvey, who then shortly after that moved to NOAA in Miami. But he was measuring PCBs in the open ocean, and I was at the same time working on the hydrocarbons. And meanwhile, on the West Coast, working in the Pacific Ocean in the same project funded by the National Science Foundation, was Bob Riceboro, who was one of the co-discoverers of PCBs in the environment, who was a close colleague of Ian Nisbet, who was science director of the Massachusetts Audubon Society, who was also seeing these extraneous peaks showing up in tern's eggs from some of the islands out in Buzzards Bay.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with environmental chemist and New Bedford native John Farrington. Coming up, you'll hear how he and colleagues pieced together the mystery of where PCBs in the environment were coming from and then brought that to the attention of public officials. Stay tuned. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. In the mid-1970s, New Bedford native John Farrington was a young researcher in Woods Hole. More senior colleagues in environmental science were puzzled by findings that oily chemicals called PCBs were turning up in ocean waters and marine life around the globe, and Farrington got drawn into the search for their source. They eventually figured out that one source of PCBs in the environment, at least in and around New Bedford, were electrical equipment manufacturers. But it took some time. I mean, it sounds like a classic mystery in some regards, and you have some of the leading names in environmental science all tied into this story of trying to figure out what are these chemicals and where are they coming from.
I would say that's true, not for me, but for those other people. I was just a postdoc at the time, and it was amazing to watch all this happen. And in fact, Ian Nisbet, many people don't know, still lives here in Falmouth, up in the Wild Harbor area, is still working on tern's eggs and tern populations in Buzzards Bay. And in the early 1970s, under contract to EPA, he wrote EPA's criteria document for PCBs.
And what does that mean, the criteria document?
Criteria document meant that it was a huge, almost 6 inches thick, double-sided review of all of the literature about PCBs in the environment.
And presumably the problems that they might
cause.
And
the problems they caused and the potential issues, and that was the basis for then EPA doing further assessments. And in the meantime, as part of our research project, collaboratively in the open ocean, Riceboro came to the East Coast, and he brought some of his new sampling gear with him. And he sampled one population of mussels, which wasn't with the new sampling gear, and water from the outer harbor. And then Bob Riceboro and I got involved in a program put together by a colleague at Scripps Institution Oceanography at Goldberg called Mussel Watch, the U.S. EPA Mussel Watch program, which was the idea of using sentinel organisms, bivalves, the blue mussels on the West Coast and on the East Coast here, different species but closely related, and oysters in the Southeast and the Gulf Coast. And we were measuring half the samples, and Riceboro was measuring the other half. And we were measuring petroleum hydrocarbons, PCBs, chlorinated pesticides. Von Bowen's lab here at Woods Hole was measuring plutonium, radionuclides, as was at Goldberg's lab. John Martin at Moss Landing Marine Lab was measuring trace metals. And out of that, it became very clear if we looked at the mussels that we resampled and the sample that Riceboro had, that the mussels in New Bedford Harbor were orders of magnitude higher in concentration in PCBs than anywhere else in the United States.
What did you do with that information at that point? Did it did it jump out that you, at you that we need to go to the EPA, we need to stop this and try to clean it up? Or was this simply a documentation effort at that point?
Well, we knew that EPA had taken surveys, so we tried to find out what EPA was doing. We went to the state agencies because Ian Nisbet knew that some of the state agency people were out sampling. And Ian, from his side, I found out, and I, from my side, were trying to contact the state agencies and saying, look, what are you folks doing about this? And it was about this time in 1976 when we came aware that EPA did have some data on fish that were very high concentrations. And I was pondering, why isn't this being paid attention to? And then the Argo Merchant oil spill happened on George's Bank. Now, there's a reason for talking about that. I'm switching back and forth. Our local state representative, Dick Kendall, at the time, went with us out on the oil spill on the cruise there. And later on, in 1977 and then going into 1978, the federal government was talking about lease sales on Georgia's Bank for oil and gas. And the then Governor Dukakis was concerned about getting information about that. And his Secretary for Environmental Affairs was Evelyn Murphy. And so several of us were asked by Dick Kendall to go up and talk with the governor about oil and offshore oil. As we were leaving, Secretary Murphy said, well, while you're here, are there any other issues we should be aware of with respect to marine environmental quality? And I said, well, there's something going on in New Bedford Harbor with PCBs, but I can't seem to get the state agencies to pay attention.
With PCBs also being found in the open ocean, I mean, it seems like it would be a pretty direct connection to think, well, there are these manufacturers right on the edge of the harbor in New Bedford. Right. Somehow PCBs are getting into the harbor, but how were they getting farther afield?
Transport in the atmosphere.
So they were actually ending up in the air.
They volatilize to an extent, and they get in the air and they get transported. And there was one thing that we learned in the 50s and early 60s that there was a lot of transport of chemicals in the atmosphere around the globe. And this came out of the measurements of fallout radionuclides from the atmospheric nuclear weapons testing. Many of the measurements made right here, actually in Woods Hole, in the Redfield building down the street, and at Scripps Institution Oceanography.
So you spoke with the governor, and what was his response when you said there's something going on in New Bedford Harbor?
Well, actually, he said, okay, and he looked at Secretary Murphy and said, well, you know, we need to take a look at that. About a week or so later, my phone rang, and there was a newly appointed person in the Department of Environmental Quality Engineering, which was responsible in the state at that time for environmental issues, and said, I understand that you're concerned, somehow your communications have gone awry in our agency. And then we sat down and started to talk about these things and compare data. And there were tables of data in different places. The Public Health Department had data. Department of Environmental Quality Engineering, EPA had data. We began to have more data. And yet there was only one chart that we had at that time where all of the different locations were plotted. And it was at about that time that I had a phone call from the city planner's office in New Bedford. And I could understand their concern. But he said, we don't need any fancy scientists in Woods Hole making, you know, $100,000 a year or more to tell us what to do with our harbor. And people who don't understand about our harbor. And I said, well, first of all, I can assure you I'm not making $100,000 a year.
I mean, I was going to ask you about that.
And secondly, you know, how long have you lived in New Bedford? And he told me. And it was a little bit unfair to do it that way in retrospect. And I said, well, actually, I lived there longer than you did. I said, I grew up there, educated there.
So you pulled rank on him.
It was... I would say it's not one of my prouder moments. I could have done it a little bit differently. Okay, but what happened after that was the state representative from there, Roger Goyette, from the north end of New Bedford, called up and said, I'd like to know more about this. I'd like to see the data and so forth. And I said, well, fine, Representative, when would you like us to come over? And he said, no, no, I want to come down and see how you folks do these things. I want to get in the lab and see what's going on. And so he came down and we showed him, you know, a lot of different data. But the one that we showed him that really made a difference was all of this muscle watch data from the oysters and the mussels all around the U.S. coast, and then the New Bedford plot. Okay, and, you know, we had the chart, and it was a classic y-axis was, you know, the coastline, and the x-axis was concentration. And everything was on the one piece of paper, except New Bedford would have been over on the wall, way over across the room. And he looked at it, and he said, wow. And so he put together an ad hoc task force using his authority as a state representative. And shortly after that, the governor, there was a new governor, a new secretary for environmental affairs, Buick, put together a task force out of the executive branch. And then the governor appointed a commission. And one of the results of the commission was a recommendation to EPA that this be a priority site. Just before that, the Superfund law had been passed.
Right, so Superfund is the law that said basically we're going to find and clean up some of the worst sites. And so the recommendation was to
put this as a high priority on the Massachusetts list, and it ultimately became a priority on the EPA list. And it's not only put it on the list, but make sure we understood how to remediate it, figure out, you know, what are the boundaries, the severity, and also who are the responsible parties, and try to get them to help clean it up.
The use of PCBs industrially was banned in 1979. It was 1982 when New Bedford did actually get added to that national priorities list.
There's some confusion about it. It was recommended in late 82. I think the final authorization was in early 83, but it's like a month.
Right. Yeah. Did you think at that point, okay, well, we've banned the use of these chemicals. We've got this site on the federal list. They're going to work on, you know, holding people responsible and getting it cleaned up. Did you think this was kind of the beginning of the end of this story, that things were going to be resolved and it was winding down?
Well, no, I thought it would take a while, or a little bit of time, because we still didn't have a good understanding of what was going on. One thing that we did have, which was a very good jump on the problem, was that scientists in the geology and geophysics department at the Oceanographic Institution in the mid-70s had done a lot of research on trace metals in the harbor. One of the other things that went on that was a good manufacturing and a good source of jobs in New Bedford was Revere. Copper and brass had a big plant there. It was the second plant after the original one that Paul Revere founded. And it was put in during the time of the whaling industry initially because whale ships had problems with the fouling on the bottom, and copper sheets were used for anti-fouling on the bottom of ships. And so it had been there for a long, long time. The people who were studying the trace metals, Colin Summerhays and his colleagues, did just an absolutely magnificent job of describing the sedimentology, the exchange of particles and water between the harbor and Buzzards Bay, the sediments in Buzzards Bay. And one of the things that PCBs do, in addition to getting into the atmosphere, is if they're in the water, they really like to sorb onto particles. They don't like to be dissolved in the water. They don't have very high solubilities like salt or sugar.
Right.
And so they ended up in the sediments. And so we knew a lot about the sediments going in. And so what we decided to do in our lab was to do a little bit of research on what we call the biogeochemistry of the PCBs in New Bedford Harbor and Buzzards Bay. How do they move through the ecosystem? How much was coming out of the harbor? What were they like? Because we've been talking about PCBs as if they're one chemical, but they're not. They're a mixture of 209 chemicals. Well, most of the major ones are less than that. Let's say maybe 100 or so.
But still, you're talking about 100 different chemicals.
You're talking about 100 different chemicals. And so one of the things we did in our lab is that we were always, in the tradition of Max Bloomer, we were always expanding our capabilities analytically, and we were able to begin to separate the PCBs more out into their individual components, which are called congeners, but that's a chemist term, so I'll call it components. And it was pretty clear that PCBs, the mixture in the mussels, was more like the mixture in the water and the sediments. But the mixture in lobsters, in lobster tail, or in that wonderful, you know, little red gland that everybody liked to eat, hepatopancreas in the lobster, the tamale, as it's called by some people, was absolutely loaded with PCBs, very high concentrations. But the concentrations, even though they were high, they were a completely different mixture than what was in the others. So when you started talking about setting public health criteria based on 2 parts per million wet weight, which was what FDA had said at that time.
So 2 parts per million of the lobster could actually be PCBs.
2 parts per million in the lobster tail on a wet weight basis. Anything more than that, it should be off the market.
Doesn't that seem like a lot?
Well,
I mean, it's not a big number, but at the same time, you're talking about eating PCBs.
That's true, but they were basing that on earlier experiments. And, you know, people are mainly concerned, or they've been concerned for years and years about cancer. But the fact of the matter is that the more dangerous aspect of PCBs is that you do not want women of childbearing age to have a lot of PCBs in their body. It gets into the breast milk and gets transferred to the infants, and there are effects, I mean, pretty well-demonstrated effects on early development of children. And so, and that's in terms of the brain and acuity and that sort of thing. And so the main thing that we were trying to point out is, look, don't think of 2 parts per million in one type of species as the same as 2 parts per million in another type.
Because you're getting a totally different mix of chemicals.
You're getting a totally different mix of chemicals. But unfortunately, at that point, we didn't have enough. We had the chemistry, but we didn't have the biological effects aspects in the scientific community. We didn't have that down to the point where we understood which of the PCBs were the bad actors.
That's environmental chemist and New Bedford native John Farrington. I'm Heather Goldstone. The conclusion of our story, including the technical and political challenges of cleaning up one of the nation's most polluted harbors, when Living Lab returns. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The space race is what inspired John Farrington to pursue a career in science, but instead of space exploration, Farrington ended up studying the history of environmental contamination in his hometown of New Bedford. He played a critical role in getting New Bedford Harbor onto the EPA's Superfund environmental cleanup list. The site was listed in the early 80s.
Yes.
Clearly, there was enough information at that point to say that, you know, there are incredibly high levels of this chemical in the sediment, in different animals, in mussels, in lobsters, in fish. We have some evidence that there are potential health problems coming from this. There was enough evidence to list it, but we're, you know, 30 years on, and people are still studying PCBs and their health impacts. How much has our understanding of just how dangerous these chemicals are changed even in the 30-odd years since New Bedford was listed?
Oh, the understanding has advanced quite markedly. The understanding of what happens at the cellular level, how enzymes are reacting in different species, which of the PCBs begin to be metabolized initially in comparison quicker than other PCBs, all of these things are well known. And in the harbor, they began working very quickly to try to figure out, you know, what is the extent of this problem? And so, you know, we had pointed out high concentrations. When they finally, we did some sediment sampling, and then the EPA and the state agencies went in and did more sampling, even the Coast Guard, and they found parts per thousand on a dry weight basis of PCBs and sediments. Actually, in the subtidal areas and intertidal areas of the upper harbor, at that time, there were intact capacitors. You could see them in the sediment. They were oozing the PCB out. And people said, well, how the heck did they get in there? I don't know for sure. But one thing I do know is that we had a huge hurricane in 1954 before the hurricane barrier was built in New Bedford. And you can go and look on various sites and find the picture catalogs that were published after the hurricane. Aerovox Corporation did one for their own plant. And you can see the plant in the middle of the storm, first floor, practically underwater. Cars in the parking lot moved around.
So, forget the amount that was rinsed out when they washed out the factory. You literally had the harbor come into the factories and wash back out.
Yes, but that was only one part. The part that, you know, years and years and years of that dribble, dribble, dribble of the stuff coming out, the factory also was a major factor. So they had a huge hot spot, and EPA went after that in Superfund right away, and they dredged that up. But then they had a problem. They could put it in a temporary secure containment facility, and then they wanted to do incineration of the PCBs in a process using what they call the six nines, 99.9999, did I get it all right? No, one more, 9% complete combustion of the PCBs, because you don't want to combust PCBs if you don't get complete combustion or almost complete combustion, because you produce polychlorinated dibenzofurans or polychlorinated dibenzodioxins, and they're worse on a per molecule basis in terms of environmental effects.
Even worse than the PCBs themselves.
Worse than the PCBs themselves. And they just couldn't convince people, and probably for good reason, they couldn't convince me that they had a monitoring that would give them a quick enough turnaround that if something went wrong with the incineration process, they could shut it off. It would take them 2 or 3 days to take the air samples and analyze them and report the data. So that would be 2 or 3 days of things going wrong.
Of these chemicals going into the air all around New Bedford.
That's right.
In addition to the technological challenges of trying to clean up these very toxic chemicals, especially when they're present in such high quantities, there's a political and a financial challenge.
I mean,
it took almost 8 years to get from the time that the site was put on the EPA's list to actually having a plan for the highest concentration part of the harbor, and then almost another decade to have a plan for the rest of the harbor. And some of that was figuring out this technology, but some of that is also trying to work with reluctant, responsible parties.
Well, I think there's that too, and certainly there were all sorts of maneuverings going on with the law, court cases. In fact, we had all of our data from my lab subpoenaed and had to show up for a discovery phase of the case in the federal court in Boston. I mean, everything. You know, lab notebooks had to be copied. I mean, the responsible parties paid for it. And we had to, all our 9-track magnetic tape data from our analytical instruments. I spent 2 days being deposed. And, you know, that was just part of the process. There was a reluctance early on. I haven't mentioned that in New Bedford, which I understood having grown up there.
You mean on the part of the community, not just the companies
themselves?
On the
part of the community itself. First of all, they were hoping that they could develop the harbor more. So they wanted to dredge the harbor so that they could have a high-rise bridge go over the harbor and you know, have ships go in and dock. I mean, it is a great harbor and a great location. And so if you have contaminated sediments, you've got a problem. Where are you going to dump the dredge spoils? So that was sort of an uh-oh period of time. And then there was the issue, which I think we can all understand, PCBs and fish from New Bedford.
Okay. Right, I mean,
is that all the
fish
that's coming from Georges Bank? You know, no, it's not, of course, but you could see how there would be a real public relations problem. Yeah, our harbor is contaminated, but the fish we're bringing from Georges Bank isn't contaminated. I mean, that's not a 3-second soundbite.
You've got a lot of fear of of, stigma and economic impacts well beyond just the shutting down of these plants.
That's correct. And it's a real problem of how you develop things along the harbor. People may not want to move there to live. I mean, there are a lot of problems associated with Superfund sites.
Has that reluctance on the part of the community shifted over time?
Yes, I think it has. I think people have understood that they're not alone. I mean, one of the problems that's taken so long to clean up the harbor is that there are so many Superfund sites in the United States that there just isn't enough money that is allocated by Congress, and it takes a long time to get through the court system to get the responsible parties to pay.
Have there been documented health problems in New Bedford that could be traced back to PCBs, and has that in any way contributed to the public attitude towards this issue?
On that one, Heather, I have to say I'm sorry, but I don't feel comfortable commenting on health problems because I'm not an epidemiologist. I know enough, having listened to the reports and read the literature, that there's a lot of arguing back and forth, but there are many, many factors that affect public health in an urban population like New Bedford.
Do you think there is concern still within the community that there could be a risk to people's health?
I think there is still concern there could be a risk. I mean, the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts, to their credit, early on banned lobstering in the outer harbor and throughout the harbor, fishing and shellfishing in the inner harbor and different zones. And then they put up signs that had, you know, in English, Portuguese, and Spanish, which were the three major languages there. And yet you still have the grandfather and the grandson out on the end of the pier doing fishing for catching a fish for Friday night dinner. And, you know, they need that in order to, you know, it's a subsistence type fishing for that particular family for that day. And you go and you ask these people, so I've been told that, and they say, well, you know, I've been doing this for a long time.
It's just the tradition and the culture is too much to...
There's a culture and a tradition. That's correct. And then, you know, the lobstermen, some of them, and I, you know, I can understand this part too. Department of Public Health draws a line across the bay on the outer harbor. Now, I haven't met a lobster yet that knows where there's a line in the mud. I mean, that's the kind of problem, you know. So you scientists, you know, you're drawing lines out there. You don't know how lobsters work. They crawl around out there. So there's a credibility issue that we have to get over. And you have to talk to them, well, statistically, this is the number of lobsters on this side of the line that have more PCBs than the lobsters on the other side of the line. But it's a tough sell.
You know, you said you spoke with the governor, you spoke with representatives, you ended up being, your data being subpoenaed.
Right.
Do you feel like you ever crossed a line from being a scientist to being an advocate in this case?
That's a good question. I think I became an advocate for paying attention to what the science was telling us. I wasn't an advocate for punish this group or not punish that group, but I understand how the law works. And certainly we as a group of citizens are responsible for the environment. It is our environment. It does not belong to individual companies. And so when they misuse the environment, knowingly or perhaps unknowingly, that is the cost of doing business. And so if that statement is one of advocacy, then yes, I plead guilty to being an advocate. But we went to enormous trouble to try to talk with the state agencies to get people involved. We did not go running out and immediately go to WCAI, you weren't here at the time, but and say, look what we found. because we knew the state agencies had a tough time. They were dealing with almost a pollutant a month in those days. And they didn't have a lot of the instrumentation that we had as a research lab here. And so we took the pathway, correctly or incorrectly, people can argue, of being partners rather than beating them over the head.
I think advocacy or the perception of scientists taking on that role has, I mean, you say you plead guilty, has taken on a very negative connotation, particularly with a lot of hot button issues like climate change. Perhaps a sense within the scientific community that scientists need to hold back a bit from the political discussions. Do you think that is something that has changed over time? Was there even the potential of a negative perception of what you were doing in the 70s, the early 80s, as we had, you know, we're talking about this kind of concurrent rise of environmental science and the environmental movement. Was there any negative perception of it at that time? Is that something that has developed newly, or was it always there?
Well, I think partly it was always there, but I had very good mentors and good role models. Because we had Max Bloomer, who was my postdoc advisor, who had spoken up, as well as had Howard Sanders, a benthic ecologist, John Teal, a marsh ecologist, who worked on the West Falmouth oil spill. And the oil companies weren't very happy about what they had to say. And I watched how they handled that and how they went to the public and how they testified before Congress and how they wrote articles for popular magazines and at the same time published their science in reputable peer-reviewed journals. So it wasn't like they weren't reputable scientists or that what they were talking about wasn't reputable science. So I really felt like there was a precedent for scientists to get involved. And yes, I got criticized for it. And at the end of the day, you have to go home and look in the mirror and look yourself in the eye and said, okay, you know, I'm doing what I think is right, and get a good night's sleep, get up the next day, look in the mirror and say, I'm going to do what I think is right today, and you go from that point on. And you listen when colleagues say, you're getting a little bit too far over here. You got to think about, are you going to spend your whole life talking to the public about this, or are you going to continue to do research too?
Do you think we will ever see a day when New Bedford Harbor is clean?
Clean, according to some definitions, yes. But we're always pushing the envelope in terms of understanding how we use or misuse the environment. We have to understand that the environment is a very complex mixture of chemicals. And we as a society are also manufacturing a complex mixture of chemicals. And we're discharging this complex mixture into this environment. We're stirring it around with wind and wave and tides, and bacteria are modifying them and fish are taking them up. Some are being metabolized, some aren't. And in the end, we're asking the question, so what's happening with these? Where are the effects? Sometimes we find them, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we're a little bit behind, like we were with DDT, like we were with PCBs. But we should learn from those lessons.
John Farrington, thank you.
Thank you, Heather. It's been a pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Stay in touch with Living Lab Radio all week. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and now Instagram. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab On The Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.